Six listeners can't be wrong.
Yeah, six Over. Listeners cannot be wrong. Rob Wolf.
Andy Dees. The Paleo Solution.
Holy cow. Gads.
Rob Wolf, Andy Dees back with episode 56, The Paleo Solution. It is sunny today, Rob. How's your mood? How are we feeling?
You know what? I put the guns away. I'm doing better. Like I was like, should it be a shotgun or should I drive my car off of a cliff? So yeah, we had three straight days of overcast and rain, and I was ready to do the whole Hemlock Society exit the scene kind of deal. So I'm very grateful for the sun. How are you doing?
I am well. Every time we have days like this, I had this roommate in college who was a very good football player. And once as a freshman, he slipped on some precipitation. And ever since then, when we were in college for 5 years, he would never leave the dorm room on a day when it rained or snowed. And so every time we have a day like that, I think of, why do I have to leave the house? But of course, I have to go to work and do all these things. But in college, when you're like, you know, 18 through 22, you could do that, especially if you're a very good football player.
Truly. Yeah.
And so then I would just join him, and, you know, we'd sit there and watch a lot of movies, Rob. It was a rough life. But
that's when you got all of your rad vernacular figured out.
That's right. Well, and that was when Jerry Springer ruled the world and was the number one rated television show.
Oh, man, that was good times. I think some of my family members made it on that show. So. My mom's side of the family.
It is very sad that Jerry Springer no longer rules the world, in my opinion.
Well, we always have reruns, so that's good.
So we're recording this like 2 days before Thanksgiving. What are you doing for the holidays, man?
I think we're going to see Nikki's family in Reno.
Cool. So snow or no snow?
It'll probably snow just because, you know, I'll be smited by God and have to drive in the snow. So, yeah, that'll be fun.
Cool. And so you guys, when do you start traveling again, right? Next couple weeks?
So we're in Woodinville for the December 4th weekend, and that gig is completely, like, over the top sold out. We've been getting a lot of pings for folks wanting to get in there, and we just can't do it. Like, we're literally dangling people from the ceiling. And so if they want to meet us in Hawaii on December 11th, then that would be good to go. And then we're not going to be back out on the scene till probably February, and we'll have an updated schedule and all the new shenanigans related to the PSS and a bunch of other goodies cooking, like information on the Paleo Physicians Network and some other things. We've got Tim Ferriss rolling on the show December 1st. We're recording it, and then we'll see when we bust that out. We'll crack it out on everybody whenever it seems to work for Tim. And what else do we have cooking? Is that everything?
Can we announce that Matt Lalonde will be on the show?
Oh, yes, we will have Matt Lalonde. We're going to start bringing – we haven't talked to Matt yet. So when he's listening to this, he'll be like, damn you, you didn't clear this with me.
I'm going to tag him in something on Facebook.
Matt and my wife possibly are in a race for being like the biggest misanthropes I know, but I love them dearly. So, yeah, we'll definitely have Matt on the show so that we can get uber geeked on that, and we're going to try to start getting some folks on the show. Should we tell people about what we're up to with other stuff?
Yeah, go for it. Let the thunder out of the bag, Rob.
So we, we put up that post about what do y'all need, and we heard about, like, folks wanted some transcription of podcasts, so we're going to look into transcribing the podcast. We're going to work on a forum. We've got maybe a T-shirt design contest thing brewing, and a couple other goodies. So just trying to make everything better, improving it. We're definitely going to work on the graphical flow charts for different things like fat loss and muscle gain, and just trying to take the information that we already have available but put it into a visual representation to make it more palatable for people to bite into it. And it's funny, like, you keep thinking that you've got all your bases covered, but, you know, we've got, like, the visual learners who like to read things, you've got the auditory people who like the podcast, and then we loop back around, and then people were saying, hey, I'd really like, you know, like a flowchart diagram kind of gig, And then people loop back around and they're like, you know, I would really prefer reading the transcript on the podcast. And I'm just like, oh man, at some point we're going to end up with a flow chart of the podcast. But
I can't wait.
Yeah, that we'll have to pull the plug on the show once it gets to that. But anyway, I mean, we've got some pretty cool stuff cooking, trying to make the offerings better, trying to help folks navigate all this paleo shenanigan type stuff as effectively as they can, and make it fun, make it interesting, help the people who are coaches and trainers to get this information out to their peeps, and just keep it a little bit fresh and different. So
yeah, so on the topic of guests, Rob, I'm gonna say, if anyone has any ideas other than wonderful Matt Lalonde, who his ears are burning, and Lauren Cordain, who's on the list, if anyone has any ideas for folks they want to see on the podcast at some point, put them in the show notes.
Somebody suggested like a celebrity death match kind of gig, you know, where like we have somebody that we just argue with, and I guess we could do that, but it just seems stressful. It seems like everything that I used to have to do with like the CrossFit HQ staff, so I just don't know if I want to do that. But if somebody really has someone juicy that they want on the show, we'll definitely consider it.
We'll take all comers if they will be on the show.
Indeed.
I mean, you know, if they're crazy enough to come on it, Rob, we'll have them. That's what I think.
Yeah, if they're okay with, like, career suicide, good on them. So.
Well, we have 7 listeners, so we're fine. Their career will not be impacted.
No.
All right, so on to the questions, Rob. We're making good progress today. That was indeed only 6 yeah, minutes the, of goofing off.
Yeah, the reason why everybody really showed up for this, so.
And also want to thank Jeff for putting together the new intro, which we edited in before episode 55. So hopefully folks like that. Rob and I laugh at it every time it gets played. So
it gives me a rib tickler. Yep. Oh, and you know what? I am going to say one other thing. When Nikki and I go to the Seattle to do the gig up there, the science fiction Hall of Fame, or like the Science Fiction Museum, has a Battlestar Galactica exhibit right now. So I am going to get in on that stuff, baby. I'm on it.
I'm very excited for you, Rob. That's a big day.
I'll take photos and video.
Well, didn't Caprica get canceled now, Rob? Did I see that's officially over?
Did it? I don't know. It didn't hook me. They should have got to the Cylon War quicker.
Yeah, I stopped after like episode 6. I just couldn't handle it really.
Yeah.
All right. Back to the questions.
Okay.
Or starting the questions today.
Yeah, starting.
Too much decaf coffee, Rob. I'm over the top right now.
Oh, man.
I know. My life is sad. So first, we got a question from Mike, and we put this in because this was emailed to you, and it's kind of a common question. So we thought we would read his question and Rob's reply and kind of talk about it a little bit. So Mike says, Rob, bought the book day it was released, 8-year paleo, 60 days, blood lipids barely budge, total cholesterol 200, triglycerides same, HDL up a couple points, LDL down a couple points, no dramatic results like promoted in the book. Is this supposed to work for everyone? Other factors to consider: take 10 milligrams a day prednisone for Churg-Strauss syndrome, which is an autoimmune blood disorder, had a beer with dinner 5 nights a week, ate a little 85% dark chocolate for dessert, Muscle Milk Light 2 times a day for added protein calories. Otherwise, no dairy, no bread, pasta, beans, just meat, veggies, fruit, good fats, workout 6 days a week, 8 hours a night sleep, 1 gram fish oil a day, vitamin D, 1,500 milligrams, magnesium, multivitamin, what now? I've been doing Loose Zone prior to this and don't see any difference. Wouldn't want to see results if I continue with paleo. So then Rob replied, Mike, first, thanks for buying the book. Really appreciate the support. As to results, we have some differences in interpretation going on. In my book, you have not yet started paleo, so here are a few things. You mentioned an autoimmune disease, which in the book I recommend no grains, legumes, dairy, tomatoes, potatoes, eggs, and a few other goodies, including alcohol, as these items are known gut irritants. In your email, we have beer, which contains gluten and alcohol, and Muscle Milk, dairy. Blood lipids. If we have any type of hyperinsulinism, the protocol in the book is grain, legume, dairy free. Again, we have problems with the aforementioned foods nearly every day, sometimes twice per day in the case of the Muscle Milk. So I have a 30-day meal plan. I recommend following that, and then we can actually evaluate a legit attempt at this. I included Andy on this so we can use it in the podcast. We get many, many emails from folks who appear not to make progress, but they are in fact not really complying with the prescribed program. Let me know how things are after you've completed 30, 60 days of the autoimmune version of the eating plan. Thanks.
So yeah, we you know, it's funny, every once in a while I'll get a consult, and this guy, Mike, was super cool. We had a few follow-up emails since shooting this back to him, but I'll get a consult and the individual is just like forlorn, and they're, you know, I'm a unique butterfly and I've done everything and my parents were heavy and it's just not going to work. And then when we start digging around, it's like, oh, you're actually not complying at all. Like, there's still tons of dairy in the mix. You're sleeping in a room that you could read a book by because it's so light. There's all these issues that end up popping up. And kind of similar deal here where, Mike maybe cleaned up his diet a little bit, I'm guessing. But then, you know, we've got a beer 5 nights a week. We've got Muscle Milk twice a day. And we've got some obvious autoimmune disease, which he's being treated for. And then what I'm guessing to be probably a little bit of kind of metabolic derangement and whatnot. And, you know, the reason why I lay out the protocols in the book, and I have all these exact same protocols available, by the way, on the website, for free, the shopping and food guide, 30-day food log, basically in the frequently asked questions tool section, it lays out all the hows, whys, and what's it's. And the reason why I make those recommendations is because they work. And largely to the degree you don't comply with them will hamstring the whole process. So it's just we're getting a ton of new people coming in and checking out the podcast, checking out the website and everything because the book is selling really well. Very grateful for that. But it's also really important to remind people that these protocols that are laid out have several tens of thousands of people kind of background with it. And it's not to say that it's the end definitive statement on this stuff, but it's a damn good starting point. And it's great to at least use that as the initiation point to start evaluating what we need to do. Do we need a little more carbs, a little bit less carbs, you know, different things like that. And if we're still doing booze 5 nights a week and 2 muscle milkshakes per day, you know, and we're dealing with hyperinsulinism and autoimmunity, then we're just leaving a ton of money on the table. So just thought it was funny, and it was good that it was actually a sunny day when this one came in. I didn't completely bite Mike's head off. So any thoughts on that, Andy?
The only thought is this reminds me of the Facebook post about the progenics just being whey.
Oh, you're right. Progenics. It's only whey protein, only 5 times more expensive than the other stuff.
But if you get someone to pay 5 times, you know, what they should be paying, it's good business.
Hey, man, it's open market. If you're willing to be fleeced, then go for it. So,
No, but this is a really common question, especially I think for folks, I guess in my experience, that have some type of autoimmune thing going on, you have about zero wiggle room to play with.
Yeah. Yeah, and the thing is that we don't yet have, or you know what, I won't say this. I was going to say we don't have the diagnostic ability to be able to figure out what exactly somebody has going on and then you know, say, okay, you can have tomatoes, but you can't have any grains or eggs or whatever. Like, we can figure that out, but it costs about $15,000 of blood work to figure out a lot of that stuff. And so instead of recommending that people do that, we recommend a basic elimination type diet with these paleo foods and you know, kind of an ordered buy-in. If you're generally just checking stuff out and you don't have a known autoimmune condition or you don't have a lot of inflammation, then, you know, grain, legume, dairy-free is a good place to start. If you've got a known autoimmune condition or you've got some other squirrely stuff going on that seems kind of autoimmune in nature, then we tighten things up another layer. And then once we get you healthy, like, here's the wacky thing we're trying to do. Let's get you healthy. Let's reverse all signs and symptoms of disease. Then let's figure out how much shenanigans you can get away with before you start showing signs and symptoms of disease. And to me, that seems like as simple and accessible an approach, and it's not a forever type thing, and it allows you to figure out what your buy-in is. But let's put the focus, again, and we're going to talk later about like goal setting and how important that is and not trying to do multiple things at once. But when somebody comes into a situation like this, let's make the goal to get you as healthy as possible, and then we can figure out how much latitude you can get away with without being sick. And then you know, you can steer the boat and be a big kid and do it however you want to do it, But if we're not getting that basic level of buy-in, basic level of compliance, then we're just kind of pissing in the wind. It's not going to fix anything.
Yes, pissing in the wind. That's a good.
it's a great visual. So
yes, thank you for that, Rob. I appreciate it. All right, indeed. Moving on. Number two, question from Seamus. Rob, two parts. Wondering if you've seen this article on high-fat diets keeping epilepsy seizures at bay and what your thoughts are. So this was in the New York Times, and the link is in the show notes.
Yeah, really, I think we had a little commentary on this, and really, really liked the article. It was a good 5-page article. The one thing I didn't like about it is that the author, who also happened to be the father of the kid that he was talking about, his son has epilepsy. The author painted the ketogenic diet as just this very austere, horrible, difficult thing, and also painted the whole thing that the kid was barely surviving due to like nutrient deficiencies and stuff like that. And there's a reality that if we tackled this whole thing in a more intelligent manner, if we use things like medium chain triglycerides from coconut oil, or maybe even some stuff from like pastured dairy, if we were eating grass-fed meat, if we were putting a focus on low glycemic load vegetable matter and stuff like that, then we really are not concerned about nutrient deficiencies, because I think one of the best treatments of this topic came out of Good Calories, Bad Calories by Taubes, which is that your need for various types of nutrients is dramatically less when we're not consuming carbohydrates in general, but particularly refined carbohydrates. So that's one caveat to this that I wish that the author was better educated on, and I don't have a New York Times subscription, and I didn't really feel I had the time to get in and like add that comment to the whole fracas. But that's one thing that I would encourage people to think about when they're considering that ketogenic diet, that the way that it's generally portrayed, you can do it in a much more intelligent and kind of clean manner, improve the nutrient delivery of the diet, and actually make the entry into ketosis easier. When you're using more short and medium chain triglycerides, it's actually easier to be in a ketogenic state. You can actually use a little bit more carbohydrate, so you can get a little bit more vegetable matter in there. Make your protein sources come from more grass-fed protein sources, and you get tons more nutrients. Wacky things like red palm oil and whatnot, so that you're getting lots of carotenoids and antioxidants. Like there are some smarter ways that we could do this, and maybe doing a write-up on a recommended ketogenic intervention for epilepsy, and we could do a comparison in the nutrient value. It just kind of occurred to me that would be kind of a slick thing to do.
You know, when you say that, that means you're supposed to do it, right?
I'll do it. I'll do that one. That one actually sounds fun, whereas most of the stuff I throw out there, I start looking at it, I'm like, God, that seems like a pain in the ass. So
we may have broken your writer's block. Go, Rob.
Go. 3, 2, 1, go. And you know what? One other thing, and this is something that I threw out there with this, I think when I did a Twitter update on this thing, is just, it's interesting to note, vegan diets are not being analyzed for use in epilepsy, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, astrocyte brain tumors, breast, colon, or prostate cancer, but yet ketogenic diets are being studied for all of those. So when people start lambasting the low-carb approach, ketogenic diet approaches, and stuff like that, it makes me want to either curb stomp or throttle them, or possibly both. And this is one of those things also that when people start doing the diet war type stuff, it would just be helpful to step back and then ask, okay, what are therapeutic interventions? What therapeutic interventions are being investigated with a vegan diet, with a Mediterranean diet, with a ketogenic diet? And it's pretty telling what that ketogenic diet is being used for. And I'm not saying that everybody needs to be in ketosis every day all the time, but it's very, very telling to me that you can see such broad application to this approach. And when we start looking at the adaptations that we see with caloric restriction and intermittent fasting, the main benefit seems to be like changes in glucose metabolism, modifying insulin secretion and sensitivity, and it looks a whole hell of a lot like a moderate protein, high fat, low carb ketogenic diet. So that's just a thing for folks to keep in mind.
And part two from Seamus. Congrats on the book. Did I read this? No. I didn't need to be sold on anything you wrote, as I'm a big believer. Great reference tool, source of inspiration. Going to make a good holiday present for the fam. Cheers.
Oh, everybody will hate him after that.
Well, Rob, you know, I did lend my dad a copy of your book, and he didn't give it back to me. He kept it as reference. So
right on.
Think about that.
The book's doing well. I'm impressed. The book is doing well. It seems to be making some headway into realms beyond just the paleo primal nutcase crowd. So it's pretty cool.
Welcome to the lunatic fringe. Next, we got a question from Mark. Our son Jack, now 5 months, poops only once a week, usually on Tuesday. He is breastfed, and my wife eats paleo. And I was wondering if any other paleo eating mothers have reported the same sort of thing. Not concerned that anything is wrong with them, and I know that infrequent pooping can occur with breastfed babies in general, but I'm wondering if it is common with moms who eat paleo.
I'm going to have to defer to the paleo parents out there on this one, as we have not yet had a kid, and I am not well steeped in the stool habits of newborns. So, paleo parents, what do y'all think on this? Definitely chime in on the comments when this thing goes up.
And thanks, Mark, for the question. Rob, I notice you're, as you, I think we'll hear you answering less and less kid questions. That's my current thinking of where we're heading with that.
It's an easy way to slip out of it and just let the experts do it. People get less pissed off at me, too. So
I know, Rob. Well, children are not little people, and you need to know that. Next, we got a
so much potential material there.
I know. Next, we got a question from Adam. Hey, Rob and Andy, thanks for weighing in on the decaf coffee topic. I can see dosing yourself pretty hard frequently with caffeine being somewhat bad. Not sure if I'm willing to stop, though. I suppose the brevity of my question took away from its original intent. So this is my second attempt at a decaf coffee question. How do you feel about the preparation methods to make decaf coffee? From what I've heard, read with only a brief Google search, they might be a little shady. Thanks for continuously dropping knowledge bombs. You make my morning commute much more bearable.
Yeah, I mean, there are some decaffeination processes. We have a link to the Wikipedia. Adam supplied the Wikipedia deal with the decaffeination. Like, you can have this run the gamut from like a supercritical carbon dioxide extraction process, which I think is pretty benign, to some kind of wacky chemical stuff. I think you just kind of find a good quality coffee and ask them what type of procedure they use, and go with something that doesn't involve like benzene or hexane or something like that. You're probably pretty good to go.
It reminds me, I received a funny email this week, and I won't mention her name, but she may be listening. But she said, I noticed that Melissa Urban from Whole Nine stopped drinking coffee. Rob has significantly cut down his coffee, and you, Andy, are only drinking decaf. Please tell me I can still drink coffee, because without coffee and bread, my life will be incomplete.
I'm still drinking coffee. I've just seriously curtailed my intake. But, you know, it's interesting, since I've been home and I've been sleeping well, like my tolerance for it is a lot greater. So and it's not to say I should push that tolerance, which is what I've historically done, but it is interesting. I think it's just one of those things, the additive effects, like, are you sleeping well? Like, Andy has to get up early because he's got early training clients, and I think that seriously impacts your ability to tolerate the caffeine. Like, if we had you on a later wake-up schedule, you probably wouldn't be as affected by it. So it's kind of that total package.
Yep, I'm waiting for that noon wake-up schedule to kick in, Rob.
the noon what?
Noon wake-up schedule.
Ah, yes. Well, yeah.
Someday. So yes, you can drink coffee. Just don't drink 64 shots of espresso a day, and you'll probably be okay.
Yeah. I'm basically at two-shot Americanos, and I'm doing a lot better.
Cool. Next, got a comment from Jonathan. Rob, love the book. Quick question. Paleo 4 months now. Have lost a lot of weight. Feel great. Blood tests will soon show if other improvements made as well. Have been working on strength and conditioning too, using sliced meat and sweet potato post-workout as per Dallas and Melissa. I find that on some longer Betcon workouts, I feel like I need some Gatorade or something, especially when combo like thrusters and burpees. Would it be helpful if I drank some coconut water during the workout? What about a banana 30 minutes or so before I start to prevent potassium depletion? Is that a real thing? Thank you.
Rob's reply: what is your goal, fat loss or performance? Jonathan's reply: I want to lean out, 5'10", 268 when starting SNC training in August, now 245 and a lot stronger, while building strength and stamina.
So I was just had a really great phone call with the Whole Nine Hooligans last night, talking to Melissa in Dallas. And this is, you know, a really important distinction here. And if you notice, Jonathan's deal is like, I want to lean out and build strength and stamina. And so, you know, which is the primary goal and where you add along the continuum? And there's kind of a reality that if you really want to accelerate the fat loss deal, I think being a little bit on the skinnier side of the carb equation is a really, really good way to go with that. We have a question here in a little bit that kind of ties into this, and we'll look at that one in isolation. Like, at the end of the day, if we generally have some calorie restriction, then we can navigate this thing pretty well, almost regardless of what type of macronutrients we have. So long as you have enough protein to prevent muscle loss and whatnot, you know, you could have higher carb or you could have higher fat. I just tend to see protein and fat plus training to be very, very beneficial because it normalizes appetite. People aren't hungry. They tend to lean out very, very fast. Then once we get them down to a good lean level, then we start ratcheting up the carbohydrate. And so in a stepwise fashion, or even like a block periodization fashion, we're picking a goal, we're chipping away at it, and then we're shifting gears and doing other stuff. So that's my only, you know, caveat with this. And if people are still overweight, I don't think there's anything that we can do that is more important than getting them lean, both from an aesthetic standpoint, a health standpoint, a sense of success standpoint. And then once we get them lean, then we can start ratcheting up the carbohydrate, and then we shift gears, and it's like, okay, now let's pick some performance criteria that we're going to shoot for and go with that. And it's not to say you can't do all of them at once, but it depends on who you are, where you're entering into this. If you're a newbie, then we can get all kinds of mileage out of adaptation. If you're a more advanced strength athlete, then it's not going to work so well. But I think to the degree that people can pick a goal and go with it and then reach that goal, then shift gears and do something else, that they're going to do much, much better. And it's not to say that the strength and stamina are not improving along this line. It's just not going to be as good a thing. And so, like, this desire to, like, drink Gatorade during your workout and stuff like that, I just don't know if that's all that important relative to just getting leaned out.
Yes. Cool. And we have a related question, I would say, from Five Fries. And he says, hey, Rob, I'm trying to understand the balance between leaning out, training capacity, recovery, and fueling. Can you train enough to fuel your body with sweet potatoes and still lean out? Let's say Roy Nelson came to his senses and decided to drop down to 205 or even 185. What would you have his training look like, assuming he's still rolled and sparred? What would you feed and water him with? How long to drop that belly? Thanks for all the help. It is much appreciated.
Yeah, so, I mean, and if folks aren't familiar with Roy Nelson, like, he's big fat dude. I mean,
he's a big fat dude.
He could kill me 20 ways from Sunday, but when you look at him, I mean, he's got that distended abdominal adiposity that is obviously like metabolic derangement just brewing, and, you know, some sort of high carbohydrate intake, whether it's beer or Gatorade or mother's milk or I don't know what it is, but, you know, it's that's a problem. And so within that context, like, you could do almost anything with someone like that and get some pretty good results. Like, you could run a gram of protein per pound of body weight. You could refuel him with sweet potatoes post-workout, but keep him off of whatever liquid carbohydrate that he's taking in, because I guarantee you the dude is doing massive amounts of some sort of, like, liquid calorie, liquid carbohydrate deal. And you could lean him out pretty effectively while maintaining his work output while training. Now, if I really wanted to reverse the metabolic derangement even quicker, though, I would drop his carbohydrate intake quite a bit and just reverse that metabolic derangement as fast as we could, start getting him leaned out, and then ratchet that carbohydrate intake up you know, once the dude was leaned out and we had the metabolic derangement kind of figured out. So again, you know, you could run this thing and try to tackle it in a concurrent fashion. And like if he had a fight looming fourth and we needed to get him down a weight class rather quickly, then we would try to introduce some mild caloric restriction, remove all of the liquid carbohydrate out of his diet, take care of post-workout refueling with solid real foods, and just lean him out at slowly but with a concerted effort, you know, somewhere between like a 500 to 700 calorie a day deficit, and just kind of working within that. And that's if, say, like we had a fight that was coming up like 12 weeks out or something. We needed to legitimately lean the dude out. If we had more time and he was in off season, I would break this up into a block periodization type deal, work on getting him lean while also assessing what type of S&C stuff he had going on, and also look at his fight game and figure out what holes in his game I would want to fix. And then we could tackle all of his leaning out, reversing his metabolic derangements, and tackle his technical elements of his S&C and his fight game in a way that is relatively low work output but highly technical, but would involve a fair amount of volume of work. But it could all be kind of fat mobilized, fat fueled, and then as we get the dude leaned out, then we can start shifting him into more fight preparation type stuff, and then do a mesocycle block in which we start building his work capacity back up, his sport-specific work capacity, put him into a strength maintenance cycle, and then hopefully get him, you know, ready for his fight, and then launch him and be ready to go. But you have to be willing to shift gears. You have to be able to triage what you're doing, look at the time frame that you have to work with, and then figure out which course is better. Are you going to try to do things in like a conjugate or concurrent fashion and try to accomplish a bunch of things all at once because you're time crunched and you're going to make the best that you can do with what you have? Or do you have enough time to do kind of a block periodization approach where you have some characteristics that are in a maintenance phase, and then you're emphasizing some elements of your goal orientation, which in this case would be leaning him out, and during the course of leaning him out, it's a perfect time to work on lower work output, higher technicality elements of his game, whether it was grappling or clinch or stand-up or whatever.
I can't believe you said the periodization word, Rob. Everybody knows that's not a real thing.
The fact that you can't predict what somebody is going to be doing on December 12th of 2020, that definitely means that it's pseudoscience.
Next oh, question man. From Roger.
Oh, man. So much good material out there.
I know. Low-hanging fruit. I've purchased and read your book and love your podcast. Thanks for the great work. I eat a small square of dark chocolate almost every day, so I have several questions about dark chocolate. Is it good for you in small quantities, or is it junk? If so, how small? Let's start there.
Gosh.
maybe you can tell how Nikki eats dark chocolate.
Seriously. It's pretty damn yummy. I would put this in the largely... junk but worthwhile junk, you know, given how good it is, and then like a real low carbohydrate load and stuff like that. So yeah,
I eat 85% dark chocolate. Is there a minimum percentage I should look for?
I think like 85 and up is a good spot, just because it really minimizes the carbohydrate load. I think that's a smart spot to be.
I find myself sick after eating some 85% dark chocolate, but that's only because I have to eat the whole bar at once, I've realized.
You know, oddly enough, I experience no problems with eating the whole bar of dark chocolate.
Well, that's indicative of other challenges I have, I think. Three, are there certain ingredients that I should avoid?
Oh, man, I would just look on the package and, you know, clarify that it's not made on equipment that is shared with, like, wheat and, you know... The gluten contamination deal is a big one, which a number of dark chocolates actually have some gluten contamination because of the processing facility. So I would keep an eye out for that. Matt Lalonde really doesn't like the soy lecithin, but it's such sparing amounts of soy-derived you know, phospholipids that we're getting in that soy lecithin. For me, I don't really care, but this could be a great Matt Lalonde question when we get him on the podcast, unbeknownst to him. He doesn't even know he's going to be on it yet, but that'd be a great question to ask him, like, how bad is soy lecithin in your opinion, you know? And especially when it's just so damn hard to find any alternatives, and that soy lecithin acts as an emulsifier. It allows the lipid and non-lipid components of the chocolate to stick together nicely, so it really adds to the mouthfeel and all that stuff. So kind of an acceptable evil, in my opinion.
And Rob, the final important question, what makes the best dark chocolate?
Man, that Preluce stuff is amazing. Absolutely amazing. I would also put the Trader Joe's 85% dark chocolate lovers chocolate pretty high up there. Lindt is some good stuff. Like, they have an 85% and a 90% dark chocolate that's pretty damn good. Scharfenberger, I'm not really that big a fan of. It's a little bit on the scorched, toasty side, which is a little bit of a bummer because it's a Northern California company, and I'd like to throw them some love, but I'm just not really all that big a fan of it. And I know there's a ton of other options out there, but those are the biggies. Like, I think some of the endangered species ones that are high cacao content are really good.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Next, got a question from Bobby. Hi, Rob. Since going paleo about 2.5 months ago, I've developed issues with my throat. Now having phlegm issues, which I always assumed was allergy-related, is nothing new. But now whenever my heart gets pumping a bit, I feel the need to spit. My friend who has been on the diet for a few more months than I also has this issue. Additionally, certain foods seem to give me throat discomfort. Even a sip of alcohol makes it feel swollen, and even coffee sometimes. I assume these two things are related, if only because they occur in the same place. Is this a common symptom amongst paleo dieters? No one in the message board world seems to have an issue with it. Do you have any idea what might be causing it? The health benefits have been great enough for me that I can deal with this, but if there's something simple that I can do to get rid of the throat discomfort, I would love to hear it.
Yeah, this is totally news to me. You know, unless, again, like, this may be an interpretation thing in which Bobby is generally eating pretty well, but then once a week is doing like a waffles and cheesecake bender or something like that, and is actually getting kind of a gluten response. We definitely see problems with what I would call dysphagia, which is some difficulty swallowing, some GI irritation from grains, and it seems to get more accentuated when you are generally eating grain-free, but that's not because you are more sensitive, it's just your gut has healed and you're getting a more pronounced immune response to it. So I'm not super sure what's going on in this situation, you know, like how frequently, like Bobby mentions that certain foods like alcohol makes it feel swollen, so, you know, like how often is that stuff happening? You know, so that I think that there's probably more to this story than meets the eye here. So if Bobby wants to follow up and mention, you know, provide like a sample meal plan for a week or something like that, then we could probably dig in a little deeper on this. Hello?
I'm talking into mute, Rob. It's totally fine. I was enjoying some of my decaf coffee that's almost gone for the day, and it'll be a sad moment in my day.
We'll have a moment of silence for you.
Please do. Please do.
Oh, wait. We just had a moment of silence.
I'll edit that out, Rob. Don't worry. It's fine. Hi, Rob and Andy. Great job on the podcast. Always full of great info. Just a quick question. What do you think of lactose-free milk? I like a small amount of milk from time to time in coffee and making scrambled eggs, etc. I've been using raw goat's milk and just happened to see the lactose-free stuff in the shop the other day. Thanks, guys.
You know, it really just depends on how you want to roll. I in general, like, if you've got a good source of, like, some raw grass-fed goat's milk, I would personally go with that. The lactose deal, some people end up getting very farty and like, some GI irritation from lactose specifically, but keep in mind that there are also other potential gut irritating elements like the beta cellulin and casein itself from dairy that can be problematic. Weird deal. Like, I just don't seem to get much problem from goat's dairy at all. Like, I don't get acne. I don't get any type of GI disturbances or anything. So if you're going to use a little bit in your coffee and stuff like that, I would personally just kind of go with the goat's milk, mainly because I think this is going in that like A1 versus A2 type of casein, with most of the cattle that we see being an A1 type of casein and being kind of much more gut irritating and pro-inflammatory than the A2 variety. So I would kind of opt with that. And then beyond that, like the lactose versus lactose-free stuff, I don't really see a big distinction there.
Yep. Cool. Question from Ben. Hi, Rob. Trying to convert my mom to eating paleo and taking high doses of fish oil. She's MS, and I feel this would help her with flare-ups and other stress-related issues that are detrimental to MS. I am lost and need help directing my mother. If you have any info on why it benefit her and maybe some studies that back it up, I would be grateful. Thanks.
You know, that if you look in the frequently asked questions, there's this thing dealing with autoimmunity, and there's actually a 7-part video series by Lauren Cordain, or 6-part video series dealing with the etiology, pathophysiology of multiple sclerosis, and it recommends essentially like grain-free, dairy-free, paleo diet with the further exclusion of eggs, tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants, and all the rest of that stuff, which this is straight out of the autoimmunity recommendation that I have in my quick start guide, and then also the autoimmunity section of the book. So, I mean, one of the requests that people had was for some research compilations. You know, basically we have some disease states, and then we would put some research in some easily accessible areas. That seems like a reasonable thing for us to do. I would like to make that kind of a community-driven deal and, like, just ask people to look around and look for, you know, like, Whole Health Source has a ton of great information, and we can kind of link back to that with specific disease processes and then in addition to different, you know, peer-reviewed literature and stuff like that. But there's good information out there. My book has it. The Quick Start Guide has it. Basic deal is grain, legume, dairy-free. Make sure her tissue vitamin D levels are somewhere between 65 and 80 nanograms per deciliter. She needs to sleep in a pitch-dark room. She needs to get a handle on her stress. And these are just non-negotiable issues. She's got to do it, or that MS is not going to resolve. And if it doesn't resolve, then it gets worse. So that's kind of the stuff to do.
Yep. All right, cool. Good question. Next, got a question from Carrie. Rob and Andy, first and foremost, great job on the podcast. And Rob, great job on the book. I'm plugging along and did not skip all the geek speak in the beginning. I do have a couple of questions. One, I'm definitely not your normal podcast listener, all six of us. I am not, in all capitals, a CrossFitter. I have no clue what a block of food is or CrossFit Filthy 50 is. I am a chubby gal. Being honest, I am, according to the BMI charts, a obese gal, 5'6", 220. I know. Wow. So to my first question, obviously I need to lose a considerable amount of weight and really have to change a lot of bad eating habits. I've been primal paleo for 3 weeks and have only lost 2 pounds. Would you suggest getting RMR tested and keeping a food calorie log, or just get even tighter on eating, eliminating fruit? I will occasionally have berries for breakfast, cutting out nuts, etc. For exercise, I have no problem. Love to exercise. I take long walks, sprint occasionally, and lift heavy things, throw around kettlebells.
Yeah, I mean, tightening up the chow, making sure the sleep quality is there. Like my usual fat loss flubs are no liquid calories, no dairy for protein sources. Make sure that you're not overeating with sneaky things like nuts and fruit. Not overtraining. So I think there's probably just a few little tweaks to do with this. And then also, don't look at the scale. Like, take the scale and give it to somebody that you don't like and let it mess with their head. Pick some performance goals and then take some tape measurements and let that drive what you're up to and not the scale weight. Because if we're reversing some metabolic derangement and stuff like that, you should gain some muscle mass, and that's okay. And that can kind of bugger the perceived weight loss thing. And it really just doesn't matter if we're making you stronger and healthier and leaning you out. So I wouldn't look at the weight per se to a large degree.
Yep. Number two, listen to the podcast with Whole Nine where frozen food was discussed. It seemed like the good, better, best did not include any frozen foods, but instead to eat local, organic, in season, etc. However, as Andy will tell you, living in Ohio doesn't offer a whole lot of time for in-season produce. Should I not eat fruit and veggies at all when they're out of season in Northeast Ohio, pretty much 6 to 8 months of the year? Go with frozen, or would you suggest I move to a warmer climate?
Oh, dude, the warmer climate for sure. But short of that, you know, I would just limit fruit. Particularly, you know, we've got this goal of leaning out, and so yeah, I mean, to really limit the fruit intake and stick with trying to get like that gram of protein per pound of body weight, lots and lots and lots of non carbohydrate dense veggies, and then just a little bit of extra good fats, and you know, the fish oil, the sleep, all the rest of that stuff.
Yep. One quick question for Andy. I heard one of the podcasts. You are from Ohio. Also noticed that you pronounce the acronym ASAP as the letter A, and then SAP as in the stuff that comes out of a tree. My husband has never heard anyone but me pronounce it that way. He says the correct pronunciation is ASAP. What do you say? Is it an Ohio thing? Did you ever serve in the military? Maybe it's a military thing. I don't know. I'm going to say it's an Ohio thing, Rob. I did not ever serve in the military. What do you say?
I have said ASAP too.
Yes. One thing I do know that is an Ohio thing that an English professor in college taught me is that people from the Midwest send us, well, end sentences with prepositions like, where is my pencil at? Rather than saying, where is my pencil? So that, I'm sure, is a Midwest thing. I don't know about ASAP. It just makes way more sense than saying ASAP, in my opinion. That's all I got, Rob.
Yeah. It definitely the military deal, like they like stuff to roll off the tongue quicker for yep. expediency, and ASAP is much faster than ASAP.
So. Yep. You heard it here first, ASAP.
It's the Midwest way to do it, therefore it means it's right.
Exactly. It's the heart of it all, Rob. Ohio is the heart of it all.
Indeed.
Next, I had a question from Ben. He says, I have a question. I am 31 years old, 6 foot, 158 pounds, slim and lead an active life, but not overly athletic. I ate very clean, 100% paleo, no dairy, no grain, no legume, all meat and veggies. 2 weeks ago, I started a RIP starting strength program with a personal trainer who is from the Oli lifting and CrossFit world. I've never lifted weights seriously before. My goal is squarely to put on weight. I'd like to see what it feels like to walk around at more like 180 or 190 pounds, at least for a while. It is a self-experiment, but a serious one. I like the fact that at this point in my life, I can control my body hormones, metabolism to this extent. Obviously, lean muscle weight is the real goal, but I've heard a lot that fat gain will probably accompany me in this journey, and I'm reconciled to that in a minimal way. Anyway, I keep hearing from people that with a strict paleo approach to living eating, I'll not be able to get in the calories needed to succeed with the weight gain on the starting strength program. I'm wondering your take on this. I really want to keep all dairy and grains out of my life completely. Right now, I'm still on just good meat, fat, and salad-y veggies, excuse me. So I'm not taking in any starch, even though I have no problem per se with sweet potatoes. I just feel that up to this point in my time with this style of living, I have not had a need for them. I can manage to get around 3,500, maybe 4,000 calories per day, and right now with all that coming from meat, fat, and green veggies. But I'm hearing from people and reading that I'll need more in the 6,000 calories a day range to make good progress. So I guess I'm just not sure how to make my digestion stomach can handle with only meat, fat, and veggies to get to the 6K range. I feel like I might have to spend all day near a toilet or something. Is starch truly the key to sneaking in those extra calories? Okay, thanks so much for your time. Be well.
You know, I think one thing I think that just for a little variety, doing a big whack of carbs post-workout would be great, and it just kind of switches stuff up. And also that whack of carbs tends to tweak hunger in such a way that you're actually hungrier later. And so I think you're able to get in more calories in the grand scheme of things. And it's just kind of hard to tell where the calorie buy-in is going to be for you to make progress. If you're just following starting strength and you're not out running around doing filthy 50s and aerobicizing, then you may be able to grow just fine on like 4,000 calories a day. Could you grow faster on 6,000 calories a day? Maybe, but you know, there's definitely a spot where you start taking in so many calories that you're just getting fat. And in the process of just, you know, I know, shocker, but when you start getting so fat, we start skewing things out of a nice anabolic hormone profile. We start getting cortisol because it's actually a stressor. We start getting an aromatization of testosterone into estrogen, and none of that stuff is good. And, you know, doing things like the 1,000-calorie curry, doing the 1,000-calorie omelet and stuff like that, like you can very quickly get – you know, a base level of 4,000 calories in, and then with a little bump here, a little bump there, like, you know, like a big yam or sweet potato feeding once a day or something like that, you know, post-workout, even post-walk if you wanted to do it in an insulin-sensitized state, then you can sneak in another, you know, 400 or 500 calories in a way that actually makes you hungrier later. And it's all staying clean. It's all staying pretty healthy. And I would just play with that for a chunk of time and see where you go. Being 6 foot, 158, I feel like you've got nowhere to go but up. Like that's pretty light in the shorts. And I think you could make really good progress. And then if you start slowing down you say like you get to 175 or 180 and it starts bogging down, you start not really able to maintain that linear progression on the strength work, then I would consider, you know, like the half a gallon of milk a day or something like that, or even a gallon of milk a day, and push that linear strength progression until you're up to the 180 to 200 pounds, and then you could lean back out and kind of go from there. But I've seen people go in on this and go so dirty with the food that, you know, they gain a lot of muscle mass, but then when we lean them back down, they just don't accrue or maintain all that much.
Hey, Rob, how'd that work out for you, buddy?
Awesome. Awesome. Doesn't sound like Ben has like a raging cortisol issue, though. So he could probably do what I did and get a lot better results out of it. You know, I mean, that was the deal when I was at the Pulican Biosig gig and I was trying to do this mass gain. He's like, dude, you need to go low carb, you need to not do any type of metabolic work, and you need to get a handle on your cortisol issues. And I ignored his advice and suffered the consequences for my ignorance and hubris. So there you go.
But you did have fun eating entire jars of almond bar or almond butter all the time.
I didn't. I hate it.
And thus began the end of Rob Wolf eating nuts.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Well, Rob, that is it, the end of episode 56. How do you feel?
I feel good, man. I feel strong. I feel good. I'm going to go work out.
How soon before Matt LaLonde emails you?
he will probably letter bomb me here pretty soon. Ted Kaczynski went to Harvard, didn't he?
He may have.
Yeah, yeah. I could see Matt doing that, or like putting some sort of chemical on like my toilet paper such that it gives me like a hive on my fanny or something. So, yeah.
All right, man. Well, thank you. This will go up after Thanksgiving, but have a good holiday, and we'll talk to you next week.
You too, Andy. Talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
Bye.